Welcome to a new edition of the Famous Interviews with Joe Dimino. On this episode, we talk with former New York City firefighter and inventor of football safety equipment, Mr. Brian Williams. He holds a U.S. patent for a safety system that addresses the injuries helmets can't prevent. After a number of young amateur players died from playing tackle football, not to mention the ones that were paralyzed, Brian spent years developing a NASA-validated protection system. The problem? He can't get manufacturers to pay attention. We talked to him about why a billion-dollar industry ignores proven safety innovation and what parents need to know about the equipment their kids are using. Over his career, he spent 40 years in safety, critical professions like construction, New York City firefighter, and private security before turning his attention to the deadliest problem in youth sports, catastrophic head and cervical spine injuries in full contact sports. From his base in Florida, we get into the whole story. Enjoy this interview.
How you doing?
Hey, everything's good, man. It's great to meet you. My wife is totally addicted to firefighter shows. So when she catches wind of this, she's going to totally flip out. She watches every single one of them.
So. All right. So you want to hear a funny story about that? So I've been doing private security for years. I actually started in nightclubs back in the early 80s. And I joined the fire department, right? And then I'm still working a side gig doing security. So a friend of mine was a consultant on Rescue Me, Dennis Leary's show.
Yeah.
So I'm at an event. And he goes, "Oh, Brian, you're going to meet Dennis Leary." And Dennis Leary comes over and he goes, "Hey, man, how's it going? He's a great guy, great. You know, what do you think of the show?" And I smile. I said, "Wow, my wife loves it." And he goes, "Well, what do you mean? You're fine. You don't like the show." I said, "Dennis, listen, not for nothing. I know it's Hollywood, but your show, everyone in that show is insane." I says, "Everyone I know is married, multiple kids, working two jobs." And he goes, "Yeah, but who's going to watch that?" I said, "Yeah, you got a point." I said, "But very entertaining."
Yeah, for sure. For sure. Well, it's great to meet you. I love your backstory. I love what's going on. So thank you so much for taking a minute out for the program. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, you bet. So let's begin our journey before we get into your good work by asking you this. 6 years ago, this pandemic changed so much about our world. How did you get through that era? And how has it changed the way that you operate today?
Like so many other people, it was kind of bizarre because I was down in Florida. My son had graduated and went to school in Florida. So we came down here to check the place out. And Florida is one of the places that didn't shut down. But then right before COVID hit in, late 2019, I had to go back to New York because my mom got sick and I was the health proxy. And then they locked everything down. And she wound up passing right before Christmas. But, you know, the project I was working on, pretty much everything just kind of like shut down. And then I got COVID, wound up in the hospital, and my wife got COVID, and the kids got COVID. And it was just a surreal time. And, it was just kind of being able to function, especially a place like New York where they locked everything down. And then for those of us like myself who started to question things, it was kind of bizarre because people would yell at you. I'm like, "Listen, why can't I ask a question here?" You know, I was retired, so I wasn't forced to take the shot, but friends of mine who either for religious reasons or medical reasons didn't want to take the shot were told, you know, cops and firemen, "Well, if you don't take the shot, you're going to get fired." And they were like, "Well, that's not fair." And some of them refused and wound up losing their jobs over this, you know, the same in the military. So that whole thing, and especially now that's what's coming out now about all that time, it was just a bizarre time. So for me, everything kind of shut down except for just surviving that, you know, living through it, you know, taking care of my family. And then once we got back into it and life kind of opened up again, I look back at that kind of like I look back at 9/11. It's all a blur.
Yeah,
it almost seems like it didn't really happen, like you watched it in a film. And I think that's a mechanism to like kind of go past it, because if you just think about it every day, what happened, especially if you believe that things were forced on you that weren't safe, it's infuriating. So to get by is just to kind of like, forget about it and just, you know, move on.
Yeah, that's it.
You know?
I totally get it. But there was something different about that time period. It didn't feel right. Like, I remember being in Europe during 9/11. I was in the back of a water taxi. My dad was born in Brooklyn, raised in Long Island, so he was a New Yorker. And I remember after that happened, I just, I had to try to get back to America. And it was a different time. There was a different level of solidarity. There was no smoke getting blown. We just knew that there was something that needed to be addressed. But with COVID, there was things where none of it ever felt okay. Like there was
No.
always like, what the hell is going on? So you wear a mask all the way to the restaurant, you ingest large quantities of food and particles and keep it off the whole time and
Right,
breathe all
right.
that out. What sense? Like there was so many discrepancies that were
Yeah,
strange.
it none of it made sense. And you're absolutely right. The one thing I do remember after 9/11, when I first went down, I wasn't home for a couple of weeks. So, think of how hard it must have been for my wife and kids, but when I did finally go home, I just remember for months after that, I had never seen so many American flags. There was no road rage. The people were polite to each other, at least in New York anyway. And it was a different atmosphere. And the whole idea of terror is to lock people down and make them afraid to go out and and afraid of each other. And honestly, it had the opposite effect, at least in New York. People came out and they banded together. I remember being down in 9/11, there were celebrities down there handing out sandwiches and coffee and asking, can we get you anything? And it was, like I said, it was a really nice time in that respect where people came together, forgot about all their issues. Like I said, I don't remember a lot of road rage. And then as time went by, people started going back to being people, and it's like now, I don't even know if they still teach it in schools anymore. It's kind of forgotten about.
Yeah, it certainly is. So let's get into what you're doing now. Obviously, you retired from being a firefighter, but now you're doing something totally groundbreaking. So I want to put you in front of 13-year-olds at career day, and one of the kids wants to know what you do for a living. How do you answer them?
So right now I still work security. I work for a family down here. I run a small team of guys and just run the estate. But when I first retired, I was always tinkering and I'm still working on this, but a friend of mine had gotten paralyzed. He fell off a ladder. And one of the things that some of us had complained about, especially with the new gear that they brought in the 90s, is that your feet, when ladders were wet, you would slip off the ladder. So I was working on a design for a safety ladder when I saw the movie Concussion. And I had never heard of CTE. And whenever I hear or read or see something I've never heard of before, I need to know more. A friend of mine calls me, Williams, you're a freaking glutton for useless information, and I'll just read and dig and again, I'll spend hours researching something. So I started reading about CTE, which took me down this rabbit hole of injuries. And what I didn't realize, the amount of not only concussions, but the amount of kids that are paralyzed and actually killed every year playing football. I was shocked. So I kept reading more and what was being done. And one of the interviews that I had read on YouTube, they were interviewing a guy that was testing. He had a company that tested equipment for the NFL, and they asked him about Riddell's new helmet, and he just kind of sat back and he goes, I don't know why they keep doing this. The helmet from 30 years ago worked just fine. Now, obviously, they've gotten much better since then, but his point was the helmet was designed for skull fractures. It was designed to keep your head from cracking open like an egg. All these other injuries, cervical injuries, concussions, CT, the helmet will never stop those. So she asked him, well, what's going to stop it then? And he says, until somebody comes up with something that can prevent the head from moving any more than it would naturally, this is still going to happen. And I don't think anything like that can be invented because it'll be too restrictive. So you're always going to have these injuries. So I was like, well, that's kind of a defeatist attitude. All the money and smart people we have in this country, we put people on the moon. You can't figure out how to fix this. So I thought about it, and I'd forgotten about it, and thought about it again. And then, my wife and I were in a restaurant, and down in Florida here, everything's a nautical theme. So there was a giant mock-up of an old Navy Mark V diving suit, which is basically a big canvas with a giant brass helmet that with little portholes in it. And I looked over and I'm like, wow, that would work. My wife's like, what are you talking about? The whole football thing, I can't get out of my head. And that image just kept rolling around and rolling around. And I started talking to people. I started talking to coaches and players, and like what would work here? And the one thing that a high school coach friend of mine had said to me, he goes, yeah, Brian, that's a great idea what you're trying to do, but the one thing we teach our kids from the time they're peewees is head on a swivel, head on a swivel. And I remember playing hockey, it was the same principle. The hit that you don't see coming is the one that really hurts. So they'll head on a swivel. I'm like, okay, well, how do I fix that? And I called my brother up, who's a builder, he's a master carpenter, and I said, Chris, I'm working on this thing here, and I'm just trying to figure this out. And I told him what the coach had said, and he goes, "Well, it sounds like you need a ball bearing ring." I said, "A what?" He goes, "Yeah, you got a lazy Susan in your kitchen." It's a lazy Susan, a cabinet thing. Yeah, go pull that thing out. So I pull out this lazy Susan, and he goes, "Yeah, flip it over. You see that ring?" I say, "You mean that cheap piece of plastic?" He goes, "Yeah, but there's industrial ball bearing rings." He goes, "You big dummy, you're on a fire truck. That big pedestal that the turns the ladder all around is a giant ball bearing ring in there." And sure enough, that's the instant that I said, well, maybe this is possible to do something. And that started this whole process of modifying and looking and building a first prototype in my garage, then going to a patent attorney and doing patent searches and then getting another prototype and then another prototype to the point where I'm at now. And I have some really, really good people on my side, including, former NFL player, and they're all trying to help me move this forward. And now they just accepted me into SBA program down here, where they want to steer me through government grants for the military, because they think the military would want to get a hold of this for their soldier program, to help these guys get injured, or prevent injuries, so to speak.
Sure. Yeah. So, sometimes you hear about these inventions and it goes up against what they're typically, whether it's their vendors or there's this philosophy of what they want. Are you seeing any resistance to what you're doing? Anybody out there that might resist it?
Yeah. So just to give you an idea, obviously, pretty naive going into this. I figured if I could make something and show that it worked, I didn't want to open up a business. I didn't want to manufacture. I figured I'd just, lease or sell the patent right to the existing equipment manufacturers. You guys make it, you make it, get it on the kids' heads, and crickets, no response. And my lawyer was kind of like, yeah, Brian, they're not going to talk to you. You're an outsider. And I actually even had a one meeting with the NFL through a friend. And the executive from the NFL brought a consultant. He consults, he's a professor of bioengineering at Duke University. So this guy, Barry Myers, came on the call. He did most of the talking. And what do you want to do? And he had the same response that everyone else had. When I show this and they tell people, they kind of like, yeah, and then I'll pull out the prototype and I'll start moving it around. They all go, oh, now I understand that. That might work. So he basically said, yeah, Brian, he goes, from what I'm seeing, there's no reason why this shouldn't work. Come back to me with testing and I'll walk it in myself. And that's when my attorneys got involved and said, Brian, listen, he goes, forget the NFL. The NFL is very resistant to change. Most of those guys are getting big bucks, and the older you get playing with your gear, the less likely you are to want to change. Like, I remember when hockey went over to the helmets, And most of the old timers didn't want to wear it. And, you know, Ron Duguay was a guy that had this permed hair, and he refused to wear the helmet because he says, "No, the ladies like my hair flowing when I'm skating down the ice." So they just refused, and it had they were grandfathered in, but then once they mandated it, anybody hired after that date would have to wear it. So, and he goes, "Listen, just from an economic standpoint, the NFL is only 1,600 players approximately. You know, there are over 5 million amateur players in the country. Focus on them. The kids are more likely to adopt something new anyway because they're kids, and you know, parents." And coaches, they care more about player safety for kids than they do, you know, adults. The adults are, you know, they understand the dangers. You know, they sign a waiver, they're getting paid billions of dollars. Kids don't understand danger. They just want to go out and play with their friends. And, you know, to find out that kids are actually dying and getting paralyzed playing a game is horrifying. So the fact that they won't talk to me, initially, it was a little frustrating. Now it's a little infuriating. You know, if you want to tell me why my design won't work, that's fine. You know, I'll accept it and go, "Yeah, I see what you mean now." And but not to say anything and just ignore it. And then your answer to that, have you seen what they're using, what's been approved for safety? So the two things that the NFL has actually approved for players to wear, one thing's called a Q collar. Don't ask me. It's a hard piece of plastic that goes around a guy's neck, and it's based on the anatomy of a woodpecker, if you believe that or not. And the whole idea is, if you get hit in the pressures, it's supposed to cut off blood flow and improve, you know, fluid in the head. I'm like, yeah, I'm not putting it on my kid's neck, or I'm not wearing something like that. So the other thing is this guardian cap, which is basically a piece of padding that goes on top of the helmet.
Yeah, I've seen that.
Yeah, it's just more padding. Going back to that original interview that I read, again, it's not going to do anything, you know, as far as I'm concerned. Now you have some people playing. The NFL is claiming that it reduces concussions by 50%. But then if you read you know, Chris Nowinski, who's head of the Concussion Legacy Foundation, oh, he took them to town. He asked them, "Where's your data and how did you come up with those numbers?" They just refused. So then when he asked the makers of Guardian Cap, how does this help? Like, what numbers? Well, the NFL has stated that No. I didn't ask you what the NFL claimed. What are you claiming? And they won't say it because they can't back it up. But parents are buying this for their kids based on that claim.
Wow.
And then Nowinski did a little research and found out, parents, if you think you're helping your kid from concussions based on what the NFL says, just know that Guardian Caps makes two versions, and the one you're putting on your kid's head is not the one that the pros are wearing. And immediately Guardian Cap had to put out a press memo. So, well, we use the lighter ones for kids, and you know, and it's the other one's too heavy. No, you never said that. You sold 500,000 of these things. So listen, if you want to wear something and it's helping you, all I'm saying is that these injuries and these deaths keep happening. And this is a multi-billion dollar industry. And the best you can come up with is more padding on the top of the helmet. I'm sorry, that's unacceptable.
I totally agree.
So I think what they're doing is just, you know, they're ignoring me, according to my attorney saying. And then if I make too much noise, they'll just say, "Ah, you know, he's a retired fund. What does he know? We've been, you know, doing this, you know, for so many." And my attorney just keeps saying, "Brian, just keep doing what you're doing, make some noise. Ultimately, some parent or somebody, you know, in the youth league is going to go, why isn't anyone looking at this?" And that's the point of doing podcasts. Like, you know, my son is the one who told me, "Brian, you know, Dad, you got to do podcasts." And the first thing I said, "What do you mean, Joe Rogan?" He goes, "Yeah, Joe, yeah, he's got a podcast, but there's a lot of other pod." I didn't know anything about this. He's the one who turned me on to Podmatch, and I mean, it's fascinating. But if people want to talk to me about this, you know, absolutely. I'd love to get the word out, but just someone in the industry, tell me why you won't accept this and I'll walk away. But they won't do that. They won't even acknowledge that. And they all have it. You know, I've had FedEx. I have documents that they all signed off on this. So they have it. They have the patents. They know what it is. My attorney is basically saying, he goes, Brian, you have to understand, just because someone's in the safety equipment business doesn't mean they're interested in safety. They're interested in money and numbers. Now, that doesn't mean everyone who works for these companies is a money grummy. You know, there are a lot of good people that are trying to do good work, but they're also limited into what they're doing and what they're producing at the moment. And anything that's just disruptive, which is what my attorney calls disruptive technology, you are a threat to them because what you've made doesn't exist. They make a helmet and they make a shoulder pads. It's separate. It's a completely separate issue. You've made a three-piece system now that will, you know, if it's, you know, refined and perfected, will stop these injuries. That's a threat to them because you're not one of them. You're an outsider, and you know they don't want to deal with you. They're hoping that you know, you either walk away or you just get tired of paying the patent fees, and they'll just file a new patent on it. So it's definitely an eye opener. So
Absolutely. So let me ask you this. I want to go back to career day. Did you always want to be a firefighter? What was your dream?
Well, that's weird. I could never make my mind what I wanted to do. If you go back and look at how many different jobs I've had. No, I was really into the martial arts when I was younger, and I met a guy that I didn't know at the time, but he used to own not own, but own the club that did security for the original Studio 54. And now he had his own company and they were doing other clubs. And you know, I had met him in scuba diving. That was another thing I used to do. And we kind of hit it off. And you know, so I come down to work nightclubs. And you know, and after you know a few months, I said, John, you're not paying me enough for this, man. It's like it's every weekend was a brawl. You know, this is back in the 80s when you know nightclubs were crazy. And you know, they had this big club called the Palladium. And you know, every weekend it was insane. So he said, yeah, you know what? You know, we're moving up to some bigger venues. We're gonna do some celebrity stuff. And you know, we have this new client right now. We really think she's gonna take us place. She's about to hit it big. And it was Madonna. So that was their first big client. And I just stuck with them. And I still work for them. I still do remote work and some computer work for them. So I've been with them a long time. So that I was working with them back, I think it was the mid late 80s, that a friend of mine had come to me and said, Brian, what are you doing? I said, no, I'm having a great time, man. You know, I'm a boss. You know, he goes, listen, if you're looking to get married to your girlfriend, have kids, you need to get a city job. And I'm like, city job, I didn't even get out of here, you know, and I didn't want no part of it. But then they worked on me, and then I realized, yeah, that was the way to go. So I took all the city tests and, you know, the police department, fire department, you know, sanitation. And it was really a no-brainer that you took these jobs because it was protection for your family. So I didn't have anyone in my family that were, you know, police officers or firefighters. You know, I took all the tests, but it was simply when they called, I just went because the way my friend described it, he goes, look, you have kids now. You can break your leg skiing and be out for 6 months. And every 2 weeks you get a check coming in and all your benefits are covered. And that's pretty much with me what it was about. But during that time, I did all kinds of other stuff. Like I said, I was always doing security, but then yeah, there's a whole litany of things, you know. I was restless, you know, and I had to keep myself occupied.
So, what was it about your upbringing that gave you this level of ingenuity with what you've designed with the pads and the helmet? And then being a firefighter, because I think firefighters are like the astronauts on Earth. There's so much courage and dexterity and strength that goes into that job. But then on the other side of it, you're inventing and you've got this ingenuity. How did this hybrid come together to become you?
Well, I'm one of seven, and When my parents would go away, they had to scatter us to their brothers and sisters, so I had, different times, different aunts and uncles. And I always went over to my one aunt's house, and she would tell my mom, "Chicken, gotta stop sending Brian here. He takes every toy out of the closet from the kids, and he takes them apart, and I can't get them back together again." So apparently, from a very young age, I always needed to know how things worked. I was always doing puzzles and building models, and my brother became a carpenter. He taught me carpentry. But when I went to the fire department, what was interesting, two things, is that back when I got on, most guys had a trade. So I was always around carpenters, plumbers, masons, electricians, welders, every trade you can think of. There was someone in the firehouse that knew how to do that. So you wind up learning a lot from these guys if you were willing. You go and ask them, and we always helped each other. If we needed to put an addition on our house, or if somebody had to, fix a boiler, there was always, one of us. It was like a barter system. We always helped each other out build this stuff. And what's interesting is the fire department gave out one set of gear for all of New York City. So no matter what borough you worked in, you had the same set of gear. The problem was every borough was different, and the buildings were different. So what I found out in working around the city was that guys would modify their gear to fit the existing buildings that they were working in. They would weld different pieces on it. They would make a 3 foot tool, a 6 foot tool, and it was just their way of working in their environment. Yeah, okay. And some of them would make their own tools. I got taught how to make tools and weld, and so I learned a lot working there from these guys on how to do all this stuff. And that's when, like I said, I had an idea of improving on the safety ladder after my friend had gotten paralyzed. So that's where all that came from. Like I said, I learned a ton of different trades from these guys. And so I was always tinkering. I was always messing around with the tools. I love playing with the tools and trying to make something new. And when this whole thing came up with this helmet design, my attorney said something funny once. He goes, "Brian," he goes, "I've been doing this for a long time. Most people, at least in this country, most people at one time in their life have a great idea that would probably make them super rich, and they just forget about it. And either it goes by the wayside, or somebody else thinks of it, and then 10 years later, oh yeah, I thought of that a long time ago, and but they didn't do anything with it. So it takes a lot of perseverance," he said, to keep pushing through from an idea to an actual item that you can, you can market, or in your case, lease to someone. As I said, I don't want to fight with anyone. I just want to get this out there and, get this on these kids' heads, but yeah, that's pretty much in a nutshell what happened with me.
So let's say you have a dream tonight. You run into the 18-year-old version of you and you walk into a room at your age now and there's a film projector. You click play, 60-second highlight reel of your life comes up on the wall. Would that young version of you believe that you've lived this life, that you've all of these things have happened?
No. Only because I had no idea at that age what I wanted to do. Even, years later, somebody asked me when I was a fireman, "Well, what do you want to do?" I says, "Ah, when I grow up, I'll let you know." And this is when I was in my 30s. I was always there, and even friends of mine, "Ryan, what are you doing today?" I was like, "Ah, I'm trying this, and like I said, I was always doing martial arts. Then it was scuba diving, and I still have my bucket list. I'm still trying to figure out how to jump out of a plane, and and it wasn't an adrenaline thing. Like, I'm not an adrenaline junkie. Some people are adrenaline junkies that love roller coasters. I can't stand roller coasters because I have absolutely no control, and I don't like that. I just want to try everything, or at least things that I was, able to do. And I still do that. There's still places I want to go and I want to travel, but this thing, I don't know why it was such an itch that I had to scratch in the back of my head, and I couldn't I couldn't get rid of it. And I spent months, thinking about it and then letting it go. And then a few months later, it's not like this was all overnight. It just wouldn't go away. So, I finally had to do something about it. And that's when I started working in my garage, and it's gotten to the point we're at now.
So, in that 60-second highlight reel, what are you the proudest of? What are you the happiest about?
Probably my family. I raised two boys that I love very much, and over the years, people have asked me, oh, how do you raised such great kids, and they're respectful, and meanwhile, in the back of my mind, I'm like, a little pain in the asses, and they were teenagers, and but I, my dad was a World War II vet, so. They had a certain way of raising kids. And, I just turned around and raised my kids the same way. It was about, respect and that whole God, country, family thing, and I believed in that, and I lived it, and I still follow it. So yeah, that's probably my proudest moment. That and the people I was able to help as a fireman, or firefighter, I should say. You have to, say that now.
Yeah, sure. So let me ask you this. Everyone has a perception of you. Family, friends, everyone that you're trying to sell your equipment to, everyone that knows you as a firefighter, but you're the one that's run the show. What's your perception of you? Who do you think you are?
Ooh, that's tough. Somebody wears a lot of different hats. I always said that, I just wanted to be able to accomplish something that, my kids could say they were proud of when I was gone. So, I think working for the fire department, was an admirable job. I mean, with helping people. And then, focusing on doing other things that, it's not just lining your own pockets and, pleasing yourself, which we all do. We all try to make our lives comfortable, but it's just a matter of perception. How comfortable now we complain about little things, whereas, during my parents' time, it's happy, just to have, enough food on the table. So I think we have too much. And I think, especially this country, there's so much opportunity to do stuff and to accomplish things that if you complain about everything, well, that's on you. It's not because you can't do it. It's just you don't want to do it or you're too lazy, and you can blame society, you can blame your generation, you can blame your parents, but ultimately it comes down to you, and that's the way I feel. So my thing is, I'm always going to try. I'm always learning. Always trying to do better, and hopefully I've made a little bit of a difference. And then, if this thing takes off, then I'll made more of a difference,
For sure. So Triaxis protection system, if anybody wants to see the prototype, look into it more. Any of the good business, where do they go?
TriaxisProtectionSystem.com. You can go on the website. There's information there. There's more coming, about some of the things that we've done, and I got to get off my butt and get busier on social media. I wasn't a social media guy, so my son has been yelling at me about that. There's a lot more coming, and hopefully it's going to be good news in the future as far as moving this thing forward.
Absolutely. Well, I'll shout this from the mountaintops, Brian. It's been an honor. Thank you, sir. Thank you for taking a minute out, and best of luck with this.
Well, Joe, thanks for helping. Any little bit, all it takes is one person to really get this thing moving. But thanks for having me. It's been great talking to you.
Thanks for tuning in to another Famous Interview with Joe Dimino, where we cover the world of art, literature, business, spirituality, music, and more from around the globe. Our esteemed theme music was composed and produced by the great E.E. Pointer of Kansas City's River Cow Orchestra. If you want to hear more interviews, visit the Famous Interviews with Joe Dimino channel on YouTube. You can also find us on Spotify and Apple Podcasts. Thanks again for listening, and until next time.